Chapter 50. Horses head, and soon were bowling across that ancient country whose surface never had been stirred to a finger's depth, save by the scratchings of rabbits, since brushed by the feet of the earliest tribes. The Tumulides had left behind, dun and shagged with heather, jutted roundly into the sky from the uplands, as though they were the full breasts of Diana Multimammia supinely extended there. They searched Egdon, but found no Henchard. Farfrae drove onward, and by the afternoon, reached the neighborhood of some extension of the heath to the north of Anglebury, a prominent feature of which, in the form of a blasted clump of firs on a summit of a hill, they soon passed under. That the road they were following had, up to this point, been Henchard's track on foot they were pretty certain, but the ramifications which now began to reveal themselves in the route made further progress in the right direction a matter of pure guesswork, and Donald strongly advised his wife to give up the search in person, and trust to other means for obtaining news of her stepfather. They were now a score of miles at least from home, but, by resting the horse for a couple of hours at a village they had just traversed, it would be possible to get back to Casterbridge that same day, while to go much further afield would reduce them to the necessity of camping out for the night, and that will make a hole in a sovereign, said Farfrae. She pondered the position, and agreed with him. He accordingly drew rein, but before reversing their direction paused a moment, and looked vaguely round upon the wide country which the elevated position disclosed. While they looked a solitary human form came from under the clump of trees, and crossed ahead of them. The person was some laborer. His gait was shambling, his regard fixed in front of him as absolutely as if he wore blinkers, and in his hand he carried a few sticks. Having crossed the road he descended into a ravine, where a cottage revealed itself, which he entered. If it were not so far away from Casterbridge I should say that must be poor Whittle. 'Tis just like him, observed Elizabeth Jane. And it may be Whittle, for he's never been to the yard these 3 weeks, going away without saying any word at all, and I owing him for 2 days' work, without knowing who to pay it to. The possibility led them to alight, and at least make an inquiry at the cottage. Farfrae hitched the reins to the gatepost, and they approached what was of humble dwellings surely the humblest. The walls, built of kneaded clay originally faced with a trowel, had been worn by years of rain washings to a lumpy crumbling surface, channeled and sunken from its plane, its gray rents held together here and there by a leafy strap of ivy which could scarcely find substance enough for the purpose. The rafters were sunken, and the thatch of the roof in ragged holes. Leaves from the fence had been blown into the corners of the doorway, and lay there undisturbed. The door was ajar. Farfrae knocked, and he who stood before them was Whittle, as they had conjectured. His face showed marks of deep sadness, his eyes lighting on them with an unfocused gaze, and he still held in his hand the few sticks he had been out to gather. As soon as he recognized them he started. "What, Abel Whittle, is it that ye are here?" said Farfrae. "Eh, yes sir. You see he was kind-like to mother when she were here below, though was rough to me. Who are you talking of?" "Oh sir, Mr. Henchett. Didn't he know it? He's just gone about half an hour ago, by the sun, for I've got no watch to my name." "Not dead?" faltered Elizabeth Jane. "Yes, ma'am, he's gone. He was kind-like to mother when she were here below, sending her the best ship coal, and hardly any ashes from it at all, and taties, and such like that were very needful to her. I see then go down street on the night of your worshipful's wedding to the lady at the airside, and I thought he looked low and faltering. And I followed then over Gray's Bridge, and he turned and zeed me, and said, 'You go back.' ... But I followed, and he turned again, and said, 'Do you hear, sir? Go back.' ... But I zeed, that he was low, and I followed on still. Then I said, 'Whittle, what do ye follow me for, when I've told ye to go back all these times?' ... And I said, Because, sir, I see things be bad with thee, and he were kind like to mother, if he were rough to me, and I would fain be kind like to you. Then he walked on, and I followed, and he never complained at me no more. We walked on like that all night, and in the blue o' the morning, when 'twas hardly day, I looked ahead o' me, and I seed that he wambled, and could hardly drag along. By the time we had got past here, but I had seen that this house was empty as I went by, and I got him to come back, and I took down the boards from the windows, and helped him inside. What, Whittle, he said, and can he really be such a poor fond fool, as to care for such a wretch as I? Then I went on further, and some neighborly woodman lent me a bed, and a chair, and a few other traps, and we brought him here, and made him as comfortable as we could. But he didn't gain strength, for you see, ma'am, he couldn't eat no appetite at all, and he got weaker, and today he died. One of the neighbors have gone to get a man to measure him. Dear me, is that so? Said Farfrae. As for Elizabeth, she said nothing. Upon the head of his bed he pinned a piece of paper, with some writing upon it, continued Abel Whittle. But not being a man o' letters, I can't read writing, so I don't know what it is. I can get it and show ye. They stood in silence, while he ran into the cottage, returning in a moment with a crumpled scrap of paper. On it there was penciled as follows. Michael Henchard's will that Elizabeth Jane Farfrae be not told of my death, or made to grieve on account of me. That I be not buried in consecrated ground. That no sexton be asked to toll the bell. That nobody is wished to see my dead body. That no mourners walk behind me at my funeral. That no flowers be planted on my grave. That no man remember me. Oh, this I put my name. Michael Henchard, what are we to do? Said Donald, when he had handed the paper to her. She could not answer distinctly. Donald, she cried at last through her tears, what bitterness lies there? Oh, I would not have minded so much if it had not been for my unkindness at that last parting, but there's no altering, so it must be. What Henchard had written in the anguish of his dying was respected as far as practicable by Elizabeth Jane, though less from a sense of the sacredness of last words, as such, than from her independent knowledge that the man who wrote them meant what he said. She knew the directions to be a piece of the same stuff that his whole life was made of, and hence were not to be tampered with to give herself a mournful pleasure, or her husband credit for large-heartedness. All was over at last, even her regrets for having misunderstood him on his last visit, for not having searched him out sooner, though these were deep and sharp for a good while. From this time forward Elizabeth Jane found herself in a latitude of calm weather, kindly and grateful in itself, and doubly so after the Capharnaum in which some of her preceding years had been spent. As the lively and sparkling emotions of her early married life cohered into an equable serenity, the finer movements of her nature found scope in discovering to the narrow-lived ones around her the secret, as he had once learned it, of making limited opportunities endurable, which she deemed to consist in the cunning enlargement, by a species of microscopic treatment, of those minute forms of satisfaction that offer themselves to everybody not in positive pain, which, thus handled, have much of the same inspiring effect upon life as wider interests cursorily embraced. Her teaching had a reflex action upon herself, insomuch that she thought she could perceive no great personal difference between being respected in the nether parts of Casterbridge, and glorified at the uppermost end of the social world. Her position was, indeed, to a marked degree one that, in the common phrase, afforded much to be thankful for. That she was not demonstratively thankful was no fault of hers. Her experience had been of a kind to teach her, rightly or wrongly, that the doubtful honor of a brief transmit through a sorry world hardly called for effusiveness, even when the path was suddenly irradiated at some halfway point by daybeams rich as hers. But her strong sense, that neither she nor any human being deserved less than was given, did not blind her to the fact that there were others receiving less who had deserved much more. And in being forced to class herself among the fortunate, she did not cease to wonder at the persistence of the unforeseen, when the one to whom such unbroken tranquility had been accorded in the adult stage was she whose youth had seemed to teach that happiness was but the occasional episode in a general drama of pain. End of Project Gutenberg's The Mayor of Casterbridge by Hardy. Merrick by Gutenberg Edition.